Travels Thursday through Tuesday, December 18th to the 23rd at St. Mary's Academy, 1615 Southwest 5th Avenue, Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Hello and welcome to Words and Pictures on KBOO. I'm your host, SW Conser, and today we're paying tribute to Jack Oman, whose political cartoons graced the editorial page of The Oregonian for nearly 30 years. And before leaving Portland for Sacramento, Jack made an appearance and answered questions at a special reception in his honor. So today we're going to play that farewell address from December 2012 at the Oregon Historical Society, and Jack will be introduced by Oregon Historical Society Chair, Kerry Timchuk.
Well, good evening. I'm Kerry Timchuk, Executive Director of the Oregon Historical Society. And David McCullough once wrote that history is who we are and why we are the way we are. And for the last 30 years, one Oregonian has helped hundreds of thousands of Oregonians with a great look at history and kind of deciding who we are and why we are the way we are. For almost 30 years, Oregonians have opened up their newspaper and looked to see the work of Jack Oman. He has enlightened us, he has entertained us, he has educated us, he has inspired us, he has infuriated us. He's done all that, and now, after this time, as you know, Jack leaves next month to go to the Sacramento Bee. So, first of all, a round of applause for Jack Oman. So this evening is just informal, it's just a conversation with Jack. He and I have been pals for a long time. I've always coveted his hairpiece. it's real, so.
That is real as it looks.
What I'm sorry about leaving now is he won't be able to draw cartoons of City Councilman-elect Steve Novick. And Steve's over here with us, too. So Steve, welcome. So Jack, we'll start at the beginning. Minnesota.
I worked in politics in Minnesota, and I remember thinking as a high school sophomore that, well, if I can't become, you know, a senator from Minnesota, then I'll just become a political cartoonist. And little did I realize it was much more difficult to become a political cartoonist than it is to become a U.S. senator. So,
especially with Al Franken now in Minnesota.
That's right. I didn't take up wrestling. I could have become governor of Minnesota. That's it.
So you graduate from high school and you go to the University of Minnesota, correct?
I attended the University of Minnesota.
Where you became the cartoonist for the student newspaper.
Right. And I was very serious and I was very into politics and got to meet Hubert Humphrey a number of times and Fritz Mondale a number of times. And Humphrey was the junior senator from Minnesota and Mondale was the senior senator from Minnesota. And then Mondale got elected vice president and I got into politics there and I was an advance man for a congressional candidate in 1978 and worked as a young, you know, intern at the Minnesota Democratic Farmer Labor and Party headquarters office, which confirms all your Republican readers' suspicions. but I was very immersed in a very exciting time in Minnesota political history.
Yeah. But then at age 19, you became the youngest person ever to be a nationally syndicated cartoonist. How did that happen? How did you have the guts to walk into, how'd you get that done?
Well, it's funny. I've always been a quick study. what happened was is that the Iranian hostage crisis had started and I did a cartoon about it. And literally the first cartoon I sent to Newsweek, they published. And I had just turned 19 years old. And you can imagine, if any of you have any 19-year-olds, you know, I have several of them, I've had several of them, and I can tell you that, you know, that it's not really the track they're on right now.
How much does Newsweek pay you?
$100.
$100.
Yeah, now they're out of business.
You're the kiss of death, I think.
Pretty much, yeah. Goodbye, Oregon. But, you know, it's... once you get one reprint like that and you're 19 and the syndicates start paying attention, it's like, who's this guy, you know? And so it turned out that at the University of Minnesota, there was a guy who worked at the PR department, and he had been a salesman for Tribune. And so he had been watching my stuff, and he'd sent my material to the president of the Chicago Tribune syndicate. And so they flew me out to New York. And I remember I bought a $170 pair of shoes. Wingtips. And I sat down in his office, and he looks at me and he says, "Hey, are those new shoes?" And I say, "Yes, they are." And, you know, it was exciting. I got to meet Jimmy Breslin and Clay Felker, and I had some, you know, kind of, you know, glancing conversations with these incredible giants of journalism at the time. And I met Ben Bradley and people like that. And, you know, I was being watched at a very early age. And then when I had only been in syndication probably 6 months, and I was hired by the Columbus Dispatch. And so I was working on a daily newspaper when I was 20 years old.
And you moved to Columbus, I suppose.
Right. And then what happened next was I had about 40 or 50 clients, which is, that was pretty good for somebody who was 20 years old. And I signed up the Boston Globe and the Washington Post and the Philadelphia Inquirer, all three of which are still clients of mine 33 years later, whatever.
So when you're, just for the audience, when you're syndicated, so you're working for the Columbus Dispatch, so you're obligated to give them a certain number of cartoons per week, and then you're syndicated and they pick up the cartoons as they want, correct?
Right. I had been on the Columbus Dispatch probably 2 months when I got a phone call from the president of the Tribune Company, who noticed that I was wearing new shoes, and he said, "Jeff McNally is going to quit editorial cartooning." And at the time, they were talking about him quitting cartooning to spend more time on the comic strip shoe, which was patently not true. I found out 25 years later, but he was married to the publisher's daughter, and then he had an affair with the cousin of the publisher's daughter. It was really horrible anyway, so he had to go. And I can assure you that didn't happen to me at the Oracle. And so they plugged me into McNally's client list, and at age 20 I became the second most widely read political cartoonist in the United States. And so I can remember weeks right after that where I had the same cartoon in Time, Newsweek, and U.S. News and World Report. And I'll tell you, I'm not making anywhere near this now, but my first syndicate check in 1981 was for $12,000. I mean, per month, you know. And of course, everything's completely blown up since then. But, you know, you could buy a new car for $12,000, a nice one back then. And so, you know, I went from, you know, eating macaroni and cheese in my apartment in the basement in Dinkytown, Minnesota, to, you know, buying cars with the first paycheck I got, and a year later, so. And there was all this publicity. They did a full-page article in Newsweek, and they did a full-page article in the Washington Post, and so on, and, you know, these things, I had that 15 minutes of fame that everybody talked about, and I was on Good Morning America with David Hartman, and I kind of felt like his little puppet. He was about 6'9". Mm-hmm. And I experienced that Andy Warholian moment of fame. It was a really bizarre thing. And I met my now ex-wife in Columbus, and she was from Oregon. And so she really, really wanted to come out to Oregon. And so I sent an application to the Oregonian. And so Bob Landauer got my portfolio and said, "I really like your material, and would you, you know, be willing to, you know, wait a while and see when our cartoonist retires?" His name was Art Bimrose, and he's a really dear guy, and he served in World War II, and he was an excellent World War II artist. I saw some of his watercolors, and he's really lovely. And he had been there since 48, and retired in 83. So, I mean, these things are like Supreme Court appointments, you know? And You know, I don't know if I don't think we're going to have that era ever again. I mean, I made 29 years and I didn't beat him. So, and Quincy Scott had been there forever too. Oregon has all these reference points that I don't think had been heavily explored in their cartoons, except Jim Cloutier, who did a really cool book back in the 70s called Oregon and Oregon II. And he was the only one who was kind of exploring this, you know, through cartoons. And when I came out here, my father was deputy chief of the U.S. Forest Service. And so, I had that kind of background of I don't know all the fungi of the northern hardwood states and things like that, but, I was able to kind of plug in and do salmon, timber, river thing pretty easily. And I also knew that I had to make it right. And so, you know, your lesser cartoonist would draw a pine tree like a Christmas tree, right? And so, I mean, if you've been following my work, you know, if I drew Old Growth Man, it had the papery bark and the moss hanging off the twigs. And, you know, because I knew that there would be thousands of people out there who would, you know, nail me if I didn't just, you know, draw it properly. And, you know, if I drew the spotted owl, you couldn't just draw a little owl with spots. It had to look exactly right with all the little fluffy feathers. And the marble murrelet had to look exactly right. And this adipose fins had to be exactly right. And you couldn't just draw a coho salmon and not have the jaw right. And so, fortunately, I'm as obsessive compulsive as probably anybody you'll ever meet. So I was the guy for the job. But you know what's interesting? I've never thought of myself as an Oregonian. I've never thought of myself as a Portlander. I think of myself as a Minnesotan to this day. I've never plugged into that zeitgeist of Portland. I mean, you know, I live here, and if I went person to person, I suspect a lot of you aren't from Oregon, and you are from Illinois, and you've lived here, you know, 50 years or 40 years or 30 years or whatever, but you still think, wow, I'm that kid on the lake in Illinois, and or Minnesota, or, and, you know, when I came out here, it was a huge deal to be a native Oregonian. They had this group called the Snobs, you know, Society of Native Oregonian Born. And, you know, I remember, I'll tell you a little anecdote about a media figure who was out here. Bill O'Reilly, remember, was Channel 2 news anchor. And he told me, I got to be friends with him, and he told me that in 1985 that he was planning to come out here for a couple of years and then run for Congress because all the roots in Oregon, you know, he'll be on TV for a couple of years. And I said, dude, that's not how it works out here, you know? I mean, that might work in Long Island or someplace like that, but, you know, you can't just come out to Oregon and plop yourself down and get elected to Congress. And so, you know, I have good powers of observation, and I love Portland, and I'm really sad to be leaving Portland, and, you know, but I felt like I was kind of a cultural tourist in Oregon in a lot of ways. I mean, I'm a cyclist, but I'm not as good as a lot of cyclists are, and I'm a fly fisherman, but I'm not as good as some of the fly fishermen are, and so on. So, I've always felt, you know, not only was I kind of Minnesotan, but I was also kind of East Coast-ish, you know, more aggressive in a way than people in Portland are about some things. I'm not obnoxious or anything, but I mean, I'm a very high energy person. I mean, people who really know me, I'm like bang, bang, bang. And Portlanders aren't like that. You go to a cocktail party back east and what do you do? What's your name? My name is, you know, Charles Leavenworth Smithson III. You know, where'd you go to school? Yale. What do you do? I'm an associate at, some law firm in New York, and you go to a party in Portland and they say, what's your name? Dan. What do you do? I hike. Where did you go to school? Ainsworth. they're not into it, you know? And I do have a nail. You know, And I mean, I know a lot of the, you know, I mean, you think I'm going to be able to tell Bill Failing anything about Portland, you know? I mean, those guys have been here for a long time. I mean, I'm just like, you know, a car going by to some of these folks.
You're listening to Words and Pictures on KABU. I'm S.W. Konser, and today we're paying tribute to Jack Oman, whose political cartoons graced the editorial page of The Oregonian for nearly 30 years. Before leaving Portland for Sacramento, Jack made an appearance and answered questions at a special reception in his honor. Let's go back now to Jack Oman's December 2012 farewell address to Portland at the Oregon Historical Society.
So the reactions you got from the public with your cartoons, I mean, pre-internet, of course, it had to have been phone calls.
Well, it was phone calls and letters, and I'll tell you the most interesting contact I ever had from, I mean, I had thousands of people over the years call me or write me or send me emails, but the weirdest one was a letter from a woman who said, it said, "Dear Jack Olikar Oman, I really enjoyed the way you caricatured me in the bar the other night, and I really am interested in sleeping with you, and why don't you call me?" And so I was thinking, Jack Olikar Oman, what the hell is that? And it turned out that there was a guy in a bar pretending to be me picking up women doing caricatures under the name Jack Olikar Oman. So, I never tried that. It's intriguing. Where was I? I've had people threaten to kill me. There was a guy who lived in Longview, Washington, who's an NRA activist, who sent me a series of what I consider to be, you know, very threatening emails, or not emails, letters, you know, signed. You know, well, you never know what's going to happen to you if you keep doing those NRA cartoons, you know. I think back on all the contacts I've had with the public. We used to be, anybody could walk into the Oregonian 20, 25, 30 years ago. There was no security. And then I think the publisher of the Anchorage paper was killed in his office by a madman, and then they got security. And so, you know, that slowed people down a little bit, but when I first started here, it was not uncommon for me to meet a reader in my office who was waiting for me. And, you know, that's pretty troubling. They were troubled. And, you know, I enjoy contact with the readers, I really do. And I have to say that I've mostly just gotten positive reactions from people. You know, it's been about 70-30.
And then the advent of the internet obviously just increased the ability of people to respond to you personally. And
right. Well, let's just say don't read the comments anymore.
Exactly. You know. Reactions from the people you drew, from Oregon politicians. Good sports, bad sports?
Well, I was hoping you'd ask that. Because I never get to talk about this stuff. And
for those of you who don't know, I was chief of staff for Gordon Smith for 12 years, and Senator Smith loved Jack's. Every time there was a cartoon of the Minute, he wanted to buy it.
I never took any money from him.
No,
as you know,
absolutely right. Charity.
I said, you know, Senator Smith, you can send the check to, you know, you name the charity, and I think Oregon Historical Society got quite a bit of Senator Smith money over the years, which is great. And I never took any money from an elected official.
But anyway, the reactions. Good sports.
Not on
the
table. I was just thinking about all the elected officials I've known over the years and had contact with. And the first one was Senator Hatfield. And in, when I came out here, Senator Hatfield was about to become chairman of the Senate Appropriations Committee, and Senator Packwood was about to become chairman of the Senate Finance Committee. And, you know, these were like huge, respected senators, and, you know, it was very daunting to kind of come in and be expected to be critical of them. But I also got to know Senator Packwood quite well, and I'm sure that he's not in the audience, right?
Don't see him.
I'll tell you a story that I've told other people. And, Senator Packwood invited my ex-wife and I down to a dinner when we were in our 20s at the coast, and my ex-wife was real pretty girl, and there was a very long table, and I found that I was sitting at the very end of the long table away from my young wife, and Senator Packwood and my young wife were sitting chatting amiably, isolatedly away at the other end of the very long table while I was talking to Bill Packwood, his son, who wasn't much really younger than I was. And Senator Packwood asked us if we would spend the night, and my ex-wife said, "No, we're going to be leaving." So we left. And I got to know, Bud Clark had just been elected mayor when I came out here, and I had met Ivan C. and didn't really have much opportunity to comment on him, but I remember Bud Clark signing the flasher poster to me 8 days before the election, and it says, "To Jack Oman for Bud Clark, the next mayor of Portland, Oregon," and we all had a really big laugh about that. Coming in here new and having Bud, who's a dear guy and I think was an excellent mayor, but just, the energy that he brought into the office was great for me because, I was just getting my sea legs here. And I really enjoyed having him as a subject. He was so easy to draw on and was doing these creepy things all the time.
I do have a letter here, Jack. One of Oregon's politicians asked me to read tonight. It says, "To Jack Oman on his farewell from the Oregonian."
Oh my God.
"Norman McLean wrote that all good things, trout as well as eternal salvation, come by grace, and grace comes by art, and art does not come easy. I do not know how easily Jack Oman's art has come to him, but I do know that Oregonians have been deeply fortunate to have his sharp wit and talented illustrations to get to the heart of what matters to people around the state. His cartoons have made me laugh, sometimes they've made me cringe. Above all, they've made me think. From local issues to world events, Jack's observations have helped deepen our conversation, and for that, I offer my thanks. As Jack moves on to a new political landscape, I am confident he will find plenty of editorial content in California state government. My hope is that this new opportunity leaves him enough free time to explore the wild rivers and salmon and steelhead runs of Northern California. Sincerely, John Kitzhaber."
And that's pretty interesting because I've always felt that he really didn't like me. Seriously, I would talk to him and I just never felt like I was getting through to him at all. That's very bright. I'm very flattered. And I remember John Kitzhaber was dating one of our editorial writers, Stephanie Fowler, and he came to my 25th birthday party. And I had lots of conversations with him. I don't know how old he must have been, one in his 30s, I guess. But that's interesting. I'm going to frame that.
Well, let's give the audience here some questions. Yes, sir.
I bought one of your cartoons, the one with Rosa Parks and President Obama in the back seat. I thought it was a wonderful cartoon. What inspired you to do that?
If I can give you a broader answer about how I get ideas, I've always said that there are 12 basic, people say there are 12 basic novel plots, and I think that there are probably 12 basic political cartoon ideas. And how I got that idea was I had had about 3 hours sleep, and I came in and I thought, I don't know how I'm going to handle this because everybody else has done Obama shaking Abraham Lincoln's hand, and I knew I didn't want to do something like that. I mean, I pride myself on trying to come up with an idea that nobody else is going to get. And I think that that's kind of been my calling card in my profession is that, I don't use a lot of the same, imagery that a lot of the other cartoonists use. And maybe that's why I'm still working. And I just was kind of flipping through Google Images, which has been a real boon to me and other cartoonists. And I came across that picture of Rosa Parks staring out the window. And one of the 12 basic cartoon ideas is comparison contrast. Okay, and so I just saw panel one, Rosa Parks sitting in the back of the bus, and panel two, President Obama sitting in the back of a presidential limousine, and then it just kind of drew itself.
That says a little bit about your power, doesn't it, as a cartoonist? People aren't buying reproductions of stories that are in the paper. They're buying reproductions of your cartoons.
Well, you might want to pass that on to major newspaper editors and publishers across the United States, because they're not getting the message currently. When I started in editorial cartooning in 1980-whatever, my first political... There's a cartoonist convention group. It's called the Association of American Editorial Cartoonists. And when I went to the first convention in 1987, there were 220 registered cartoonists at the convention. In 2009, when I hosted the convention at, these were full-time daily newspaper editorial cartoonists. When I went and held the Portland Cartoonist Convention in 2009, there were 10 registered full-time editorial cartoonists. So I think Matt Boers is here tonight, and he was my fellow, I was a Pulitzer finalist this year, and Matt was a Pulitzer finalist this year as well, and he's an excellent young cartoonist, he's 29. And so it's a shrinking profession, and...
Is the Oregonian going to have a full-time cartoonist?
Well, you know, you can have a little evening with...
So you don't know?
...them and ask them, I don't know. I have to say, there have been 3 editorial cartooning jobs filled in the last 4 years. And, you know, that's how tight this market is right now. It's really tough. And another cartoonist, the Orlando cartoonist, was going to buy out today, I heard. The Boston Globe cartoonist was bought out 6 or 8 weeks ago. It's just catastrophic for this profession. I mean, I came out here when I was 22. I had just got married. You know, my life was completely different. And I'm, you know, a pretty kicky 52, and yet the notion of leaving is really overwhelming emotionally, and it's, you know, with each passing day, I mean, you know, I can't tell you. Spent my entire adult life in one place. I don't know what to tell you people. I mean, I wish I could stay forever, but I couldn't.
You've been listening to a special farewell address to Portland by Jack Oman, recorded at the Oregon Historical Society in December of 2012. Jack left the Oregonian for the Sacramento Bee after nearly 30 years at the Oregonian and was shortlisted for the Pulitzer Prize during his last year there. I'm SW Conser. Thanks for listening to Words and Pictures. Now stay tuned for an afternoon of music on your homegrown Portland radio station.
Now for the KABU News at Noon for Thursday, December 11th, 2014. Today, the Senate approved a new defense budget of more than $500 billion. This includes more than $60 billion for operations in Iraq and Afghanistan. The bill also authorizes the training and equipping of moderate Syrian rebel groups for up to 2 years. It allocates $5 billion to fighting militants in the Middle East, though it includes fewer cuts to benefits for military personnel than recommended by the Pentagon. It does include some, like an increase on prescription copays. It also includes a prohibition on transferring prisoners in Guantanamo Bay to the U.S., and an overhaul of the military's sexual assault policy. According to a new report by the International Coalition of Investigative Journalists, over 24 firms, including Disney and Koch Industries, have negotiated secret deals in Luxembourg to avoid paying U.S. taxes. According to the report, these companies reorganized to place their subsidiaries under the control of Luxembourg companies to avoid paying taxes. In some years, the Luxembourg branches of these companies paid less than 1%. Today, Congress passed a new budget of $1 trillion that will allow the government to avoid shutdown. The budget bill also includes a number of unrelated provisions, including a lift of laws that prevent banks from engaging in risky trading, and an allowance of exceptions to clean water laws. It also includes a refusal to fund marijuana's legalization in D.C., despite its passage by D.C. residents. The budget passed with a 214-212 split in the House of Representatives. All of the Democrats, as well as 16 Republicans, voted against it. Thousands of people took to the street today in Ramallah for the funeral of Ziad Abu Ayyin, a Palestinian minister killed by Israeli police during a protest on Wednesday. Abu Ayyin was part of a group planting olive trees outside an unauthorized Israeli settlement in the West Bank. The two governments have issued conflicting statements on the cause of Abu Ayyin's death. Israeli officials have stated that he died due to a coronary blockage brought on by stress, while Palestinian officials say that he died from being hit by a tear gas canister. The IDF has stated that it's conducting an investigation of the incident. Abu Ayyin served as the head of the Anti-Wall and Settlement Commission. He was 55. And that's the KBU News at Noon for Thursday, December 11th, 2014. Tune in every weekday at 5 for more local, national, and international news produced by our volunteer news team here at KBU Community Radio. For KBOO News, I'm James Helmsworth.